What's going on, everyone? You're listening to the Post Bougie Podcast for the week of February 6, 2011. This is Judy here with Jamel Bowie.
Howdy.
Nicole.
Hello.
And Monica.
Hello.
We are actually sitting all around a table in D.C. this week as opposed to calling in remotely. And joining us this week is a very special guest, Channing Kennedy of Color Lines.
Hello.
Channing is here to talk with us about a very interesting exchange that he and Jamel and Ta-Nehisi Coates were having kind of across several blogs about a New York Times article that was dealing with the growing number of American young people who are identifying as mixed race.
That's not nearly as catchy as the Beijing of America.
The Beijing of America. It's like the tanning of America.
Tanning of America. The browning of America.
If you say the Beijing of America, then I can use a joke about San Francisco or Chinatown.
Yeah, go ahead and make the joke.
Go for it, Jenny.
I think, let's call it a meta joke, and that was it.
Okay. So Jamel was riffing off a point that he makes a lot. Not that you're belaboring the point, I think.
I mean, no. I would totally cop
to social situations all the time.
I would totally cop to being out of ideas sometimes, just being like, I'm going to go to old post and restate that point again with a different news hook.
Jamel's point is that the way we talk about race in America is fundamentally about black and non-black and not non-white, and most of the people who are identifying as mixed race are not actually white kids and people of white and black parentage, but of white and Asian parentage or white and Hispanic parentage. But I'll let Jamel take from there.
Yeah, I mean, over the last, 30 or 40 years and into the future, or at least the immediate future, the color line will go from being black-white to being black-non-black as there are more groups entering American life who aren't black but aren't quite white as well. And the category of not black, we need to expand to include those people. I think my main point, like, now that I think about it, now that, after reading Channing's really great post and just talking to people, I think my main point is just it's important to recognize that the experiences of African Americans and the discrimination against African Americans is of a very particular kind that isn't actually echoed or isn't actually seen among any other demographic groups. That, like, the stigma against blackness is sort of unique in American life, and that will always affect how we think about racial distinctions in the country. The rest of the stuff, I personally think that over the next 50 years, you'll have a large population of white people with Latino and Asian last names, but that's, like, very contestable, and, it could be completely wrong.
We should link to that clip about Chris Rock and that whole little bit he does about black people not having time to dice white people up into little groups. Like, I don't care if you're... Am I the only one that's seen this? Like, I don't care if you're Irish, American, or you're white. That's it. That's all that matters.
Yeah. And then I thought Channing had a good... Not really criticism, but,
critique. I think critique is a proper word.
Yeah.
So my critique that I leveled against my colleague, Jamel Bowie, was... mostly just to say that, and I think Jamel has a good point. I'd actually be really interested to hear more of what he has to say about unique situations, unique hardships that black people and black communities face that other communities of color don't, because I think there's a lot to dig in there. But what I was basically saying in my piece, and I used San Francisco Chinatown as an example of a community that's fucked in a lot of the same ways that black communities are, that they face redlining, they face foreclosure, but because they're historically of color community, like they've been there for hundreds of years, and white people have not wanted them for hundreds of years. And actually, I know some interesting stuff about Chinatown that I always like to share, which I'm going to go ahead and do now that I've started that sentence. The reason that San Francisco Chinatown looks the way it does, the reason it looks sort of like a Disneyland version of Chinatown, is because after the 1906 earthquake, the San Francisco, city wanted to displace all of Chinatown when they rebuilt. They wanted to stick them out at Hunter's Bay Point, which not coincidentally is where all the black people in San Francisco are historically. And the Chinatown elders came back and said, like, no, wait, don't kick us out. We're really novel. We can be a big tourist attraction. will you let us stay here if we put a bunch of, like, pagoda-looking shit all over everything? And San Francisco said yes. So when you go to San Francisco Chinatown, you're not seeing an authentic Chinese city. You're seeing an inauthentic Chinese city designed by Chinese immigrants to look like what they thought white tourists would want to see when they visited Chinatown 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Wow.
Which was not anything that I said in the post. but it's fascinating. And it's like, learn that. I tell everyone that, like, at the grocery store, just in line. So Chinatown faces this race-based systemic discrimination the way the black communities do. It also faces a lot of the systemic discrimination that new immigrant communities, or the constant influx of new immigrants face with their undocumented populations, where those people are basically kept vulnerable because they can't organize in the workforce. There's always the threat of an ICE raid or just getting deported. Because the networks there are so insular, you see people living, like, you know, dozens of people or multiple families living within, like, a single, they're called SROs, single resident occupancy flats. There's a lot of health problems associated with that don't get addressed. The jobs generally involve the same kind of jobs that undocumented people work all across America, where they're long hours, dangerous working conditions. There's no such thing as sick leave, which again means that disease spreads faster, and that has an economic impact as well. Mm-hmm. So San Francisco Chinatown is what I was holding up as an example of a community where they have a lot of problems that are very similar to communities of black that black communities face that are going to keep them from being accepted into whiteness under the same mechanism that keeps black people out of whiteness.
I should clarify when I say unique with regards to African Americans, I don't necessarily mean sort of like unique challenges. I think the challenges a lot of African American communities face are shared by not just lower income communities of color, but lower income white communities, and say the Appalachians, and large parts of the South. I mean, just like, there's a particular stigma associated with being a descendant of slaves that is still with us, and I'm not sure if that's ever really going to go away. And that stigma is, I think, part of what keeps, you know, blacks outside of the melting pot, as it were.
I guess that's my question for you, Channing, because I know that, you know, if you're a white person and you leave, and you have the opportunity to leave a largely poor white community, the assumptions that people make about you are then sort of different if you leave. And so does being from San Francisco Chinatown, does that stigma that you may face in San Francisco, does it carry over, I guess, is my question, to other communities?
You know, I really don't think so. I can say the reason that I know so much about this topic specifically is because a commenter on Color Lines two years ago, took a real disagreement with a piece that we wrote saying, I forget exactly what, I think it was about green jobs or something like that, that said, you know, communities of color and, you know, black people, Latino people, Asian people need to work together to get these jobs. And someone said, Asian people statistically are doing better than white people. So what are you actually saying here? Are you saying that since Asian people have made it, so either you're saying, you know, Asian people are part of this group that you're lying about their money situation, their economic situation, and their position of power? Are you saying that money and power are directly related, in which case Asian people are really running the country? What are you supposed to be saying here? This person was straight up trolling, but they made a point which stayed with me as I tried to argue with them about it, which is that statistics lie. Mm-hmm. And in the way that statistics lie, we see these really poor Asian communities in some places, like in San Francisco Chinatown, like in New York Chinatown, and then we see some really rich Asian communities and Asian people spread out throughout America that cause the average to level out. So on paper, yeah, Asian people are doing great. In terms of health, I want to say that, like, Asian Americans have longer lifespans than white Americans. But again, that's an average across the board.
Right. Just to add to that, when you begin to disaggregate for, like, you know, particular groups of Asian Americans, like Cambodians and Vietnamese, have much worse outcomes in terms of education and income than Chinese and Japanese.
Yeah, you wrote a piece about that, actually, I think that I linked to in my critique, which I thought was really good. And again, this is parts of different immigration patterns, different situations when different groups of people emigrated. So Chinatown got established, I believe, when the railroads were getting built, and they were more or less brought over here by force or by economic conditions. Mm-hmm. In the 1970s, in the South Bay, there's a really big Indian and South Asian community it's the suburbs. And it's not totally integrated white and Indian, but you could be a white person and live there, you could be an Indian person and move someplace else. What's the phrase? Money lightens? And in this case, that's pretty much what happened. These people came over in a completely different situation from other Asian immigrants from 100 years ago. They came over with money and with jobs lined up, and they're doing fine now. I'm sure a few of them have gotten foreclosed on, but for the most part, they're living like white people.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's happened is that Ta-Nehisi wrote about this. I don't know if it was in conjunction with these, or if it was like a separate post. I think it was in conjunction, but that also the way that we think about race has somewhat changed as well, but that we sort of define it however we want to define it in the moment. And there was a time when you could see reference to like the Irish race and the Italian race. There was a time when those kinds of things were more complicated. And so like part of the whitening of those groups was also a relaxation of the ideas of race that we had. But I think that is also what complicates things for, like, I'm always trying to, like, understand white people who don't understand racism at all. And I think one of the things that complicates the picture for some people who are people who know that their ancestors in particular had a hard time when they came over to America. And so I think that's, like, part of the story, too, is that there are generations of Americans whose ancestors weren't considered white when they came here. And so that sort of historical sense of, like, also exclusion doesn't make them feel particularly privileged. And so what I wonder, too, going forward is how groups that are sort of, like, newly part of the mainstream will feel in the next generation about exclusion and race, like, how they'll define it and how they'll define history.
And I think, I mean, I feel like I've mentioned this in passing before, but I think that really has a lot to do with the political context in which we live, right? Like, it's entirely possible that if demonizing Latinos continues to be, like, electorally valuable, that 30 years hence, yeah, there'll be a lot of white people with Latino last names, but they'll remember when demonizing Latinos was a thing, popular, mm-hmm. and those bonds that formed during that period that create a shared political experience will stay with them, and so they may still identify as Latino in that way. Or maybe, you know, they may identify as white, but still have a strong, you know, bond with Latino political organizations. It would look a lot like, you know, Irish people roughly became white in, like, the early part of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until the 1970s that, like, Irish political machines began to weaken in the Northeast.
Mm. Yeah.
Right? Like, there can be this really long lag period between the two, if they even happen. Mm. So.
I'd be curious. Well, I know, like, and I think a community that parallels the Irish community is the Ukrainian community, like, in Chicago. That Chicago still has Ukrainian Village, where it's, you know, I think hipsters live there now, too. It's a community that 100 years ago probably would not have been called white. They would have been called, you know, they were Ukrainians, and hence the term. I don't know what they faced specifically. Like, I don't know if that community dealt with redlining. But I imagine, like most, immigrants of color that come over, like, they didn't have a great shot at things. Something that I think can't really be overstated is how different immigration and different labor situations impact how quickly a group comes up economically, and thus how quickly it's introduced into whiteness or how quickly it's considered mainstream.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so right now, like you said, there's so much political capital to be burned by demonizing Latinos. That's unlikely to go away anytime soon, and that's also worked as part of a cycle where immigration law has become very draconian, like, not more so than it's ever been, but it's definitely gotten worse, like, in the last 20 years or so, as we've seen what gets called crimmigration, where it's the fusion of criminal law and immigration, like measures like a 287G that deputizes local police forces to act as immigration officials, so that, you know, if an undocumented person calls the police because someone's breaking into their home, they run the risk of getting detained and deported themselves just for picking up the phone. Mm-hmm. That's a measure that I don't know if Irish communities faced or Ukrainian communities faced for their entire tenure before stuff got relaxed. But stuff like that is really hard to recover from, even over generations for a community.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what particular point this be making, but it's an observation at least that like demographic change also has a big impact or effect on how groups enter the mainstream, right? Like, my guess is that, you know, in Chicago, I think would probably be a really good case study for this, that a lot of white ethnics in Chicago didn't really become fully white until black immigration into Chicago.
There was a lot of pressure on the lower end, all these menial jobs that black people and white ethnics were fighting over.
Right.
You know, there were race riots and there were people clamoring for these really, really shittily paying jobs. But black people, like, shot out of unions.
Yeah.
And they couldn't organize. And so, like, black people kind of became the scapegoats for a lot of things. And so there was this, like, upward pressure.
Right.
Like, you know, towards, you know, for all these white ethnics to become just white.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the absence of that, like, that doesn't really exist anymore. Like, black migration is pretty much done. Right. Like, you know, how does that affect?
I mean, you can make the argument that there's stirrings of it happen in people who try and play sort of the black and Latino communities off against each other and saying that, like I think Ta-Nehisi actually wrote about
Ta-Nehisi
actually wrote about it, where he was saying that, you know, like, it's a sad thing to say, but I don't think that really people can unite until there's another other for them to unite against, right. And that in some cases and in some places, that's what's happening within the black and Latino community, where it's like, okay, well, yeah, you're black and maybe I'm not okay with that, but at least you're not one of those, like, Latino people out there stealing jobs or whatever. And, like, that is sort of more of a unifying force, which I think goes back to what both you, Gene, and Jamel were talking about, but I'm not sure what that bodes moving forward.
Yeah, there's go ahead.
Oh, I'd be curious if anyone on the phone knows. I know that, like, pretty much the first black middle class in America, if I understand correctly, happened in Detroit around the auto industry. Because, as soon as black people were let into those union jobs, then they were suddenly making money and they could afford to buy property. And that's why those communities got redlined, and that's why we have the foreclosure crisis now. But for a while, like, there was a real black middle class. And I wonder if that trend had continued if, like, our race situation now would be very different if for some reason redlining hadn't happened. Or if, even with that black community, if there were still a lot of poor blacks who were still shut out of jobs. What was the, like, economic dynamic within different communities there at the time?
I don't know.
I think it depends largely on where you were. Like, if you were in a sort of, and I could be completely wrong here, but like in Detroit, in an industrial area, or like you said, Monica, if you were working in sort of a Pullman cars or in a more industrialized, larger area, it was a very different dynamic than what you would get, like, let's say if you're, you know, in the South and your options are pretty much, I mean, there were a couple of sort of, I guess you could consider them like middle class black landowning families in the South, but they were few and far between. And so I think that that sort of dynamic depends. It breaks down both along the class lines, but it also breaks down, I think there's a big difference regionally, because I think that urbanization, in terms of, like, what you were saying with the auto workers in Detroit, and to sort of a smaller extent the Pullman and the train workers, like, pushed people up, you're right, into the middle class, but it's something that was not available in a significant chunk of the country.
Also, I think the way we think about middle class as it pertains to black people is a little bit different than the way, you know what I mean? Like, I think,
well, it goes back to something I think both of you have written about, where even if you're middle class, even to this day, if you're middle class and you're black, you have way more connections with lower class people than the average white middle class family does. Exactly. I don't think that was really, that might not have been the best way to say that, but, you know.
with the riffraff.
With the riffraff.
No, I mean, like, that, I mean, it's an interesting point, right? Because you may have, because, like, different regions, but still, even in the 1880s, 1890s, 1900s, still very much a nation, and people were best vaguely aware of what was going on in the rest of the country. And so you could have like a middle class black community in Detroit, but I guarantee you, most people were aware of like, you know, the virtual peonage in which most black people lived.
Right.
And so, like, this has created a dynamic where these middle class blacks aren't seen as like some of us, but simply like, the exceptions.
Right.
But most of them are basically, you know.
I mean, economic exclusion has sort of always been the point, I think, of what middle class white people do, you know, is just like, you know, economically exclude blacks. But I think part of it is like the sort of the changing nature of whiteness, I think, just makes it more important for. I think what it just does is just kind of highlight how important it is to define for the dominant group to define whiteness as non-blackness again, because it's like, you know, all the other cultural markers that you have as an ethnic person or, you know, if you're a Western European, then, you know, a few generations of marrying some German immigrants will mean that your skin is lightened and your hair is lightened and you can stop being Catholic and you can stop speaking Portuguese or Spanish or Italian and you can stop doing all those other things. But, you know, so moving into whiteness is more fluid, and so it just becomes more and more important to compare it against blackness. And so the increasing nature, I think, of the expanding nature of whiteness, I just think means in the future, blackness will just be the bigger thing that we define.
Yeah.
Jamel, if I can jump in here, I'd be interested to hear you talk about the role that you think economics plays in, and I sort of hate this term of, like, you know, ascending into whiteness, because I feel like white is not going to mean the same thing in 50 years, in the same 50 years that you're talking about. But what role does economics play, and what role does, like, just straight up, you know, people fucking each other, intermarriage rates play? I ask because economics is so closely tied to who leaves a community and, you know, goes off to college and meets someone, and who stays in the community and stays within those same social circles.
Right. As far as marriage rates are concerned, you know, I think the most recent Pew statistics show that the majority of interracial marriages occur between whites and Latinos, whites and Asians, and then the minority, and that's like close to 60%, and then like the smaller share are minority, and then black white comes at 11%. I think the children of those black-white unions over time, like, this, it's very fluid. Like, I feel like the problem with blogging about this is because if you're shooting for brevity and clarity, like, you gotta sacrifice some of the nuance here. Mm. And part of the nuance, right, is that the children of black-white unions will be, like, a step closer to just being considered white. Right? Like, I don't think the one-drop rule is in effect anymore.
Right.
So, like, you know, we were talking about this in the office today. But Rashida Jones, who is just, like, straightforwardly half black, you know, her father's black, her mother's white, is not necessarily understood as being black to a lot of people. I, for one, knew someone...
Yeah, I didn't know that she was black until, like, I looked her up on Wikipedia or something.
Rashida Jones, really?
Thank you, Channing. I was trying to make that point to Jamel.
Her name is Rashida Jones. She was,
exactly. If you can point to me a white lady named Rashida Jones.
Rashida Jones.
Jesus. I would really like for someone to work the word octoroon into this conversation.
Absolutely. Please.
You know what's funny, though, about Rashida Jones is that you see her and you're like, whose daughter is she? And then you find out she's Quincy Jones' daughter and you're like, yes, she is.
With economics, so I have this, my going theory right now is that in addition to, like, the non-black divide among African Americans, you're going to see a growing bifurcation Orlando Patterson, I think?
Yeah, I'm sure it's Patterson.
From Harvard, right?
Yeah. Orlando Patterson has a great book from a while ago where he makes the point that is rarely made and needs to be made a lot more, that when we're talking about black pathologies, what we're talking about really is a particular group of African Americans concentrated in cities in particular rural areas that are hyper-segregated. And so I think going forward, you're going to see this bifurcation of middle-class African-Americans, upper-middle-class African-Americans, rich African-Americans, and everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And that, like, that will, like, sort of intersect.
There's another Chris Rock bit about this that is not put in such pleasant terms.
Oh. I think I know what you're talking about. Don't say it.
This is gonna, like, intersect with sort of the non-black-black divide. I think it's just going to be, like, it's going to be very fluid. Like, you might have in communities, like, upper-class black families, which are, you know, have effectively escaped the stigma of being black and are seen as, like, you know, desirable marriage partners or whatnot. Nicole is
pointing at all of us
at the table. Yes. Yeah, no, it's going to be complicated. Which I wanted to say this at the beginning, but, like, that New York Times article, it was interesting to see the perspectives of all these college students, but it was really, really not... It wasn't that valuable as a piece of, like, journalism. I don't know.
No, right.
Well, though, and the criticism that you guys had that I thought was really on point that should have really been made at some point is that, like, this isn't... It's, like, a new, like, openly talked about identity, but, like, there are, like, tons of biracial people through history.
Right.
It's just that you likely did not know who they were.
Right.
Frederick Douglass, biracial.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, most African Americans are, you know, are some degree white.
Yeah.
Except this guy.
I mean, that's probably not true, though, right?
I don't know. I'm willing, I you know,
I mean, there's somebody on your tree. Somebody.
But whether that's true of someone in his family is not necessarily true. It doesn't mean it's true for him.
Right, for me. Right?
Yeah, yeah, no. Somebody in your family tree.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So. And actually, this is an interesting point to apply to Latino communities because Latino, like what we call now Latinos, are such an incredibly global, they're a result of, you know, fucking across the globe for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm.
So there's indigenous people who were here in South America and in Central America. There's Spaniards who came over, mm-hmm. who were white but who probably had some Moorish in them from being occupied by the Islam Empire for centuries. There's other white people who showed up. There's slaves from the Caribbean, from the West Indies. So it's again, like what we call Latino is sort of a ridiculous term. And actually, Asian people, like Asia is huge.
Yeah.
Asia really is huge,
and
big.
It's full of so many different people. So like my coworker Julianne Hing wrote a piece for when she was guesting at TNC's place. And talked about a photo of a Sikh community that protested in the 1950s. And she wrote, like, when I see this, I see, you know, Asian people. I see Asian people standing up for their rights. And that sort of blew my mind a little bit because I still don't have it in my mind that, you know, that Asia is that big.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That Asia
right.
includes so many different people that look so different.
Absolutely.
Right.
Well, it goes back to what we were saying earlier. Like, really what we mean when we say, not... What some people mean when they say, like, Latino or Asian is not necessarily a specific group of people as much as it's people who are not me.
Yeah, I mean, I think right. some of that is, like, I think that, and Orlando Patterson has written about this, too, and received some heat for it, but, like, the group of Americans who self-identify as Hispanic has some history in the way that they chose to act politically together in
right.
this country. And so, like, you know, there are Latino people or Hispanic people, however they identify, who are totally white people, but, like, for whatever reason would not identify as such. And so, like, some of what we'll see, I think, in the future is just sort of, like, a more truly complicated picture of that as opposed to sort of a simplified picture that political... you know, political common ground, you know, helped them seek before.
Yeah.
Really quickly, I was actually at brunch with a few of my friends a couple weeks ago, in which we were having
That's because you're part white, is that correct?
Yes, absolutely.
brunch is actually part of the white DNA.
Yes, absolutely. And we're actually having this conversation as we're saying to blackness about, like, how... I mean, I was making the point that the idea of blackness kind of blunts a lot of nuance and, like, a cultural experience. And they were like, I was getting a lot of heat for this. I thought it was a pretty straightforward point. I mean, at this table, I was literally the only African American person. The other people there one person was Eritrean by way of Toronto. One person was Antiguan by way of Ottawa. The other person was Jamaica, or she was from she was Canadian by way of Jamaica. Another person was Guyanese, who looked, and she looked Daisy. And like, I was the only person who was like, who had like an African American experience, to the extent that there is one of those things. And like, so we're having this argument in which people were saying that we share like this common kind of cultural identities, which is completely foolish to me. Like, we don't speak the same language at home. We don't, you know what I mean?
I ain't shared nothing with no Canadian.
Absolutely. I believe in your bacon. but, you know, I think there is this way in which, like, our political classifications are just really kind of, like, useless, I think. I think they get to a point where it's like they kind of blunt a lot of, a lot of, like, nuance and dynamism.
Anyway. Well, like, when you say Latino community here, like, in D.C., you're talking about a very different group of people than when, like, you say the Latino community in North Carolina, where I'm from, York, like, right. Or in New York, or in Arkansas, or in South Carolina, maybe?
Virginia.
Yeah.
Like, it's totally, you're referring to a very different group of people who, for all intents and purposes, might not, like, consider themselves very similar to the Latino community in D.C. You know what I mean? It's
And, yeah, and when you get to a place like New York, those groups start to splinter because, you know, the Mexicans in Sunset Park don't really care about the Puerto Ricans in Washington Heights or, like, what, you know, anything that brings them together. And so I think, you know, I think it's interesting to keep in mind that it's in the interest of the political classes to keep those groups splintered, right? Because it's like, should they have common political power?
Marxism.
No, really. I mean, it's like, should all the, you know, should America become majority minority and all those, you know, disparate minority groups vote together, then it's not in the interest of, like, say, the Republican Party.
I mean, there are some people who like to use across-the-board terms. Like, my grandmother, for instance, calls anyone who is not black, white, or Latino, Oriental. Like, that's it. That's just what you are. Like, that's...
Wow.
Cross the board, that's it. That's...
I had a fight with my mom about the word Oriental.
And history teacher called people Chinamen.
Chinamen.
Now we've just descended into racism. Which I think means this is a success.
I have one question that I want to pose to the group. So this is like a bigger question. Let me see how I can phrase it. One of the commenters, when I got excerpted by TNC, the commenter Cynic, who's, you know, been saying great stuff on TNC's comments for years, I think he's guest posted for him a couple times, critiqued my critique of Jamil's critique, saying that it seemed like a political frame rather than an analytical frame, that it failed as an analysis and maybe it worked as a political frame. I shouldn't say it like that. I was kind of mad about it. I don't want to let that slip. I want to make it seem like I'm cool and professional. I responded and I said, like, that's absolutely what this is. I mean, I don't have an organizer background myself, but that's more or less like everyone that I've learned about race from in my adult life has been an organizer, and the group that I work with here does a lot of work around you know, cross-racial alliances and organizing and establishing these common goals. The bigger question for me that begs is, what part of race is individual and what part of race is based on community and economics? Another way of phrasing it is, like, what is the point if all Asians, like, wake up tomorrow or in 50 years and Asian people are white, they've been accepted into whiteness, and we're just going to call them white? What does that make San Francisco Chinatown? Because San Francisco Chinatown's still going to be poor in 50 years. Does that make them, you know, I hesitate to say this, does that make them white trash? What's the distinction between race as an experience and race as a force that determines power, political power, and economic power and opportunities?
I don't got nothing for that one.
Wow, Shannon.
I wish you could see the looks around the table. Everybody's like...
Ooh.
Oh.
Yeah, it's pretty.
See, you could be video chatting, and then I would see that stuff, and then you would see me, like, eating trail mix frantically between thoughts. So that's, I guess, my question is, like, there's a Martin Luther King quote that I'm going to misquote. That's something like, there's no point in having a seat at the counter if you can't afford a hamburger when you get to the counter. And that there, like, I really hate the idea that class trumps race, but I feel like race is a lot less powerful a concept without economic factors behind it, and I think it swings both ways.
I think that's probably true. I think that's, like, maybe part of the reason why segregation was so defined by economic exclusion, right? That if you had, if you could prevent people from actually ever participating in the economic world that you decided you were going to set up, then that actually meant something.
Yeah, you put all the black kids in one school, and then you cut off all the funding to that school. Right. The second step is the important one.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and in some ways that sort of helps define the concept of whiteness, because, like, let's say that you're living in the Jim Crow South, and because there were a lot of poor white people there, you can say, well, at least I'm not black, you know, like, at least I'm not this. Like, yeah, they might have all the black kids in one school and cut off the funding from that school, and I might be in just as dire of straits, but at least I'm not that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's sort of the line that exists at the end of the day, so.
And this is when Jamel wishes he had actually paid attention to his Marxist-leaning professors in college.
Well, no, I mean, yeah. Marx didn't really have a lot to say about race.
But, I mean, like, this is, like, a fundamentally, like, Marxist view of the thing.
Yeah.
And I think it's a correct view. Marx is not as a pejorative.
Marx didn't have a lot to say about race, but, like, in recent decades, the only political party that's really cared about people of color has been the Communist Party, more or less. Because it's the Workers' Party.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You go where the voters are.
Yeah.
This is the part where I try to indoctrinate you all into communism.
You didn't know I was already a communist.
As sensible liberal.
Monica is the only person at the table wearing some shade of red, so it makes sense.
I gave up on capitalism a long time ago.
I'm just trying to get into those cocktail parties, you know what I'm saying?
On that note,
Channing, I think the answer is that we don't have an answer for you.
I think we should definitely mull this over that.
Yeah, this is something we'll have to all think about.
I will be very curious to see what the commenters have to say.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think you actually also asked the question that is the point of post-bougie.
That question was, like, kind of our mission statement in a weird way.
Yeah.
But thank you so much, Channing, for being with us.
Yay!
Thank you so much for having me. So this is... I'm not lying when I say this has been a dream of mine since I started listening to the podcast.
Oh, stop.
Aw. I wish you could see us now because we're blushing.
I can't blush. But there is blood rushing to my cheeks.
This is the downside of anti-miscegenation, is that you can't blush.
The Bowie family's hard line against miscegenation.
Thanks so much, Channing. I know it's 3 hours earlier in San Francisco or in Oakland, and so you have shit to do, so...
Well, thanks for having me on as part of your diversity initiative. I appreciate it.
Also, we want to congratulate Channing formally, I guess. Can we do that? Because Channing is engaged to be married.
I am.
Yay!
I'm marrying a white woman. Sorry.
But you could... If you guys are going to have kids, you can have little subversive white kids.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, we can just raise a bunch of little Tim Wises, I guess.
All right, man. Be easy.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks. Bye.
So for the second topic we have today, Tracy, who everyone knows is the hilarious Rookie McPoverty, who wrote a post earlier this week about this viral video in which this woman was complaining about the travails of trying to go natural with her hair. She was driving down the street, apparently, which seems kind of
dangerous.
She's
driving to the salon.
Wait, this is the video and she's driving?
Yeah.
Is she recording herself?
Yeah, she's recording herself.
It's like on the dashboard or something. She's talking into the phone.
That is a felony.
Yeah, absolutely. It was all kinds of irresponsible.
Right, well, we here do not endorse that sort of behavior, but if you're going to make a good viral video while doing that, then,
I don't endorse those felonies.
So her, the video of her complaining about the difficulty in going natural, like, she was complaining about the amount of effort and time it took to go into her hair, got a lot of attention, and Tracy was kind of posing very interesting questions about the way natural hair is marketed to people. Tracy?
Yes?
Do you want to explain what you thought about the video? And the marketing of natural hair in general?
Yes. Well, I kind of went through a couple of things when I was watching the video, a lot of different emotions because, and it's kind of funny because the first,
what's your story, Tracy? You're natural, like, right? You are natural, right?
I'm sorry?
Your hair is natural, right?
Yeah, okay. I've been natural, I think, almost 3 years now. I think it'll be 3 years in, like, June or July or something.
Okay.
I don't know. But, yeah, my knee-jerk reaction was like, oh, my gosh, your condition has been conditioned. What, you can't have beautiful, you know, your afro's not beautiful, whatever. And it's weird that I had that reaction because before I went natural, when I decided to go natural, I was living in Philadelphia. And that was kind of, like, the first time I, like, knew actual people, like, outside of, like, McDonald's commercials that were actually natural. Like, I saw it in real life, and I had a lot of friends that were natural. So I'm walking around with my luxurious perm, and I had a couple of people who would, like, harp on me, like, why do you perm your hair? It's not good for you. What, do you hate yourself? Why don't you love who you are? Whatever, whatever. And I really took offense to that because it's so rude and presumptuous to assume that I don't know my history.
What you can't see is that I am nodding my head in agreement right now.
Yeah, so what I did was, like, I became, like, this militant perm soldier, like, whatever. And then fast forward to 3 years, here I am watching this young lady rant about things that I can really identify with, and like my knee-jerk reaction was like, oh, there's something going on there. And so as I continue to watch, I kind of like fell back into my regular self, I guess, and I was like, you know what, I do understand, because natural hair is definitely difficult. And this brings me to the point that I'm about to make. When I decided to go natural, I assume, like many people probably do, that it's easier to care for natural hair. I was like, okay, I'll just cut it off. It'll be curly. I'll wash it. I'll put some moisturizer in it. And I go on my way. No. I spend so much more time on my hair now, and I just wasn't really prepared for the production that it can be. And I think that just like the young lady in the video, I too assumed that my hair would look like all of the models with the shiny, bouncy, long, curly hair.
Tia and Tamara. Those are my role models on Sister Sister. Tia and Tamara. They had those, yes. You know, they had those big, really cute curls. I was like, oh, maybe if I go natural, my hair will look like that. No.
Exactly.
Nobody's hair looks like that.
No, nobody but Tia and Tamara have hair like Tia and Tamara. And that's something that people don't realize when they decide to go natural, is that natural hair varies from woman to woman, just like anything else does. You know what I mean? Like, my hair is really, really coily and springy and just big. And my mother's hair, she's got very fine curls and whatever else. And I just, these are just things that I don't think you know, because when you're online and you're searching for information on how to care for your hair or products to get, what you're getting really is a lot of advertisements and people who want you to buy their products. So they show you these beautiful, you know, long manes of hair, like what's the girl that everybody loves from Girlfriends? Joan Lake from Girlfriends. Hmm? That's what I expected. Like, when I cut my hair, I was like, wait a minute, I don't look like Diana Ross's daughter. What am I doing? You know? So I guess when you consider all that, or at least when I considered it, I understood what she meant. I mean, it takes a long time to learn your own hair pattern or whatever you want to call it, and you really have to hang in there in the beginning, and she just didn't have the patience. So I was like, well, I don't know. And it made me wonder, like, when is a hairstyle just allowed to be a hairstyle? You know, does it have to always be this heavily politicized thing? Like, can she just not like Florida Evans hair like she referenced? Like, is that okay? You know, can it just be like, I want curls and I don't have curls, I'm going to perm it. Like, when is that going to be okay and acceptable for what it is? You know?
So, I'm going to share my hair journey, which is basically the exact opposite of yours, Tracy, sort of. Like, I have had a perm since I was probably about 4 or 5 years old. Like, my sister, my mom, and I, yeah, like, we were the little girls that you see in the salon in good hair. Like, that was me and my sister. Like, we both have insanely thick hair. Like, this is probably a little too much information, but, like, the reason why my mom started perming our hair is because my sister and I, like, would scratch so badly that we were, like, causing damage to our scalps, and she was like, well, we gotta figure out a way, like, that you're not doing that anymore. So I've had, with the exception of about a year and a half when I cut all of my hair off and then thought that maybe I wanted to go natural. And the thing that you really need to know about me is that I'm a really, really lazy person. Like, I will shower every day most of the time, and that's pretty much it. Like, I don't want to do a whole lot. Whatever. The idea of spending a lot of time on my hair is just, like, I can't. I don't. Like, it's enough of a pain in the ass that I have to, like, wash it once a week. Like, that's just...
So, let me ask you, where were you, like, in your life when you were deciding to go natural? Like, how old were you?
I will never forget. I was right before I was in 10th grade, so I was probably Yeah, I cut it. So I've never colored my hair. I always get haircuts. I've had every terrible haircut, every version of the mullet, and, like, God knows what else you could imagine. Like, I've had every bad haircut in existence, because that's what I do when I get bored. And I will never forget, it was, like, maybe a month or two before 10th grade started, and I was like, you know what? I'm just going to cut off all of my hair and see what it's like without the perm. Like, that's, I've never done that before, or if it has, it's been so long that I can't remember, so whatever. And I did it, and I cut all of my hair off. My hair was like, remember when Jada Pinkett cut all of her hair off and she looked like she was bald? Like, that's where I started out. And I kept it that way for probably about a year and a half, and I would get, like, regular trims as it started to grow out, and it is, like you said, it's a lot of work, and there's sort of this misconception, I think, that when you have natural hair that... because you're not in the salon every 6 to 8 weeks, like, paying a lot of money and slapping a bunch of chemicals in your head, that somehow it's less work. And, like, that's not true at all. Like, one of the things right. that I noticed about you, Tracy, is, like, I follow you on Twitter, and I cannot tell you the number of times where I'm just like, I am so glad that, like, I don't care if I am combing all kinds of oppression into my hair. I can get up in the morning, put it in a ponytail, put a headband on, and walk out the door. Like, I don't even have to think about it. And that's just it. Like, I used to have really short hair, and that's the same reason why I don't have short hair anymore, is because fundamentally... because
you had to fix it.
I'm lazy. And when you have short hair, when you have natural hair, like... maybe I'm being judgmental, but you just can't walk out of the house, like, and go wash and wear and look any kind of crazy way. Like, you just can't. You have to actually do something, and you have to put a little more thought and a little more time and a little more effort into it. So, for me, it's not as much of a political statement as it is, like, I am fucking lazy, and until you want to pay for someone to come over to my house and do my hair every morning, like, what I do with what's on top of my head is not really your business. Like, it's not a statement, or, what, like, this is just what works for me.
It would be awesome to have that much money. Like, if I ever become filthy rich and just really old, I'll just pay people to chew my food for me.
The only connection I really have to this conversation is the desire to do absolutely nothing to my hair. Like, if I can wash it and it can be wet and I can put it in a ponytail and go out the house and look somewhat decent, then that is the haircut
for me. Like, what you can't see is that my hair is, like, pulled into, like, a messy ponytail bun right now, because I woke up this morning and was like, you know what I don't have to worry about? My hair. Like, I gotta pick out clothes, I gotta put on shoes, I gotta shower. I don't have to worry about my hair. I'll just put it in a ponytail and walk out the door.
So do either of you feel pressure in either direction, Nicole to go natural and Tracy to perm?
I totally feel like it. I feel like it's a judgment where people are just like, especially after Good Hair came out, which I went to see with one of my friends who is not of the sort of persuasion where this is something that she has to worry about, and she was sort of like shocked at all the things she's just like, oh my god.
I didn't know.
And I'm like, yeah, like, I've had chemical burns in my head. Like, I remember when I was a little girl and, like, my grandmother used to take me to the salon and I would have to get, like, hot comb, which for those of you who don't know, is when they literally put a metal comb in a small oven and then run it through your hair. Which is a really great thing to do to a 5-year-old child, because obviously that's not
going to happen. It's 5-year-olds, still.
Right, like, they know what's going on.
Wine, yeah.
Exactly. And I just.
And it smells like burning hair.
And it smells exactly like burning hair and grease.
Yeah.
And it just. Especially here now in DC, because I feel like it's become. I don't want to say trendier, but I think that's what it is that it's become trendier to have natural hair. So, like, I've noticed, like, when I go in the salon that I go to, it's here in DC. It's on. Just off of U Street, so it's in a predominantly black neighborhood. And I get, like, looks. Like, even one or two of the stylists have commented on things and are like, well, don't you want to go natural, or why are you still perming your hair? And I'm like, because this is what works for me. Like, I just don't understand why it has to be such a very forceful statement. Like, you don't give a rat's ass what color I paint my nails. Like, this is the same thing for me. Like, this is just what works for me. Like, why does it matter so deeply to you?
I don't think I've ever felt pressure to perm my hair in my adult life. I mean, when I was younger, of course. I got my first perm, I think I was 12, I got it. And I could not wait, because everybody else in my class had perms, and their hair moved, and my hair was, like, in this big-ass braid that never went anywhere at all. I just wanted to shake it so bad. But I think that once I learned that I didn't have to perm my hair to have it straight, which I actually did not know, like, I figured that that was the only way that black people could have straight hair. Once I found that out, I was just like, well, I don't need to go and have my scalp, like, burned anymore. Like, I just don't have to do it. But as far as feeling pressure to have straight hair, to reform the question, I did once I actually went natural, and I would have to, like, go on job interviews, because I was just like, okay, I'm going to be too black for this white interviewer to want me, so I'm going to have to, like, assimilate as much as I can, you know, because, I mean, especially in Louisville, when I moved back to Kentucky, I just had so many assumptions. I was just like, I'm going to stick out like a sore thumb, and white folk already look at me sideways anyway, so me and this big-ass afro are going to have to tone it down if I want to enter into the professional world, which actually it turned out not to be true. I've gotten lots of positive responses from, I think, everybody here, and I think white folks like it the most. So I don't know how this is going to sound, but once I figured out that white people like my hair, I was like, okay, I never have to turn it. Like, I mean, at least as far as, like, jobs and stuff go, so... No, but I mean, overall, I'm very much of the opinion now, I guess, having lived on both ends of the spectrum and seeing ridiculousness on both the permed end and the natural end. I mean, hair, for me, it really is just hair. And just keep it healthy. Just don't be looking crazy. Because you can have natural hair and still look a mess. A lot of people don't know that either. Like, a lot of the naturals that I, like, talk to, like, they have, some of them, I'm generalizing here, but some of them have, like, this air of superiority. They assume that, you know, this is the natural glow that I have, and I'm just like, yeah, but your ends are kind of,
yeah, but you can use a trim.
You know? Like,
your hair's looking a little dry, just in case you were wondering.
So, I'll let the oil sheen real quick.
This is completely anecdotal, and this is probably problematic, but all the women I know who went natural after college, like, you know, like a year or two after college or whatever, when they decided to take the big plunge. And so I think part of it is, like, you, because it is so labor intensive, and because, like, you know, Carol's Daughter or Oin or whatever, those products are kind of expensive. Like, this is...
They're not kind of expensive. They are, like, ridiculously expensive. Okay. Like, so I am not afraid to admit that I buy whatever fucking shampoo and conditioner set is on sale at Target, and so far it's worked for me. Like, that shit is really... Like, at Target, it's, like, $20 for a tub of stuff, and I'm sorry, but I just... No.
Right.
I just...
So, my theory is kind of that, like, because, like, there was a point for a while. There was a point in my life in which I didn't know anyone outside the women in my family. Like, all the women in my circle of friends were natural. And my working theory was that this was something that was, like, very specific to, like, middle-class, educated black women, right? Like, this is, like, you'd have to have the money and the time to be able to do something like this, right? I mean, you couldn't... This is not something... There's, like, a different class element to, like, going natural. Is that... Do you think that's wrong?
I don't know if it's particularly wrong or right, but I don't think that's been my experience. I didn't know anybody with natural hair until I graduated college. Also, and that's because how much that was for the entire black population on my campus. So if I had a perm, then all the other white I wouldn't say that that's been my experience. I mean, I know people who, like, myself, and I'm quite broke at the moment, and I know people in like, higher tax brackets, lower tax brackets, high school diplomas, whatever, who are natural. Now I know this, but I don't know, it's an interesting observation.
Then have you seen good hair?
Oh, I've seen it several times.
Really?
I really enjoy it, because I like their little scene at the very beginning where Chris Rock's daughter is like, Daddy, why don't I have good hair? Because I very vividly remember, like, the battles that my mom and I had over my hair. And my mom was never like, oh, you have bad hair or anything like that. It's just that, like, I have a lot of hair, and it's really thick, and, like, I was tender-headed, and there was, like, lots of crying, and, like, it was a very big... It's always been, like, an ordeal for my mother to do my hair.
Are there any children that aren't tender-headed? Just as,
I mean, No.
That shit hurts.
I don't know that it's that. I think that it's more that your mom just pulls your hair too much because she's tired and doesn't... It's just, like,
yeah,
you just need to shut up and
also,
get
that's
done.
How she keeps your head still.
Yeah.
Unless she's pulling really tight, your head doesn't stay still.
Right, because you're, like, 5 years old and you want to squirm around. But it just... Like, I remember the epic battles that we had, and it's just... it's something that I find really interesting because in addition to sort of like these epic battles, and this is sort of a very cliche thing to say, but it's very much a bonding ritual. Like to this day, my family goes on like these whole, like my grandparents and all of their kids, like my mom and her brother and sister, and then like all the grandkids or whatever, like we all go to the beach together. And every morning, like my mom, my sister, me, my aunt, and her two little girls, like everybody's in a big circle, like doing hair in the morning. Like it's just sort of this very interesting bonding ritual. And I think that, not to trivialize anyone else's experience, but I think that there's something a little bit unique just sort of about being a black woman and having a child who has hair like that, regardless of what you decide to do to it. That's a very sort of interesting and deep connection, and I think that's sort of part of the reason why it's so controversial. Like, Monica, if you decide tomorrow to go out and have super curly hair or blonde hair or whatever, like, everyone will remark on it and be like, oh, your hair is curly today, but it's not, like, a political statement. It's just, like, Monica decided to do something different with her hair today, versus if you're a black woman and you decide that you want to go natural or that you want to get a perm, like, it's a statement. You are obviously trying to say something, as opposed to just, like, oh, well, I woke up this morning and got bored and decided this is what I should do with my hair.
It's funny because you guys see the stats about how much more black women spend on their hair, like, than white women, like, you know, proportionally. But it seems like it, from the way I was making it sound, it's like, even if you decide to not put a bunch of shit in your hair, you still have to spend a lot of money to, like, not put a bunch of shit in your hair. You know what I'm saying? Like, if you decide to go natural, you have to spend a lot of money. You decide, there's, like, no way around it. I mean, unless you just, you know, walk outside looking crazy. I mean, right?
Well, and there's this whole sort of set of expectations. Like, I kind of, I've been told that I feel epically because I like to use Suave or whatever shampoo is on sale at Target. Like, I'm already paying, I'm already paying a lot of money for
this Suave.
Pantene 2-in-1.
Hello. Listen, there are some places like Shoppers Food Warehouse, you can get that stuff for $1.29.
Suave is like, how could it be on sale? It's like $1.59.
I clip coupons, alright? What are you trying to say?
I'm saying, Suave is cheap.
But, like, there's sort of this whole thing where, like, I already spend a lot of money on my hair getting it perm. Like, I don't really want to spend any more money than I have to. But there's, like, a whole series of equally expensive products that, by all means, I should be putting in my hair and using every night, and I should be wrapping, and I should have, like, these special pillowcases, and, like, no, I'm not. Tracy, am I kidding?
Like,
there's a whole...
Do you have special pillowcases, Tracy?
There's a whole, like, it's like having a child on top of your brain. Like, there is a whole shitload of accessories that you are supposed to have, otherwise you're not doing it right.
Tracy, do you have special pillowcases?
Do I have what?
Special pillowcases.
No, only because I'm too lazy to get up and go and get one. So right now what I do is I have like 3 or 4 silk scarves that I just lay on top of my pillow so I can
see,
get
wow. See? It's like this whole epic thing that I guess because my mom is sort of lazy in this way too, where she's like, I'm not wrapping my hair, I am not buying a special fucking pillowcase for my hair, like, I'm just not doing it. So I, like, never caught on to it, but my aunt was a beautician, and it's just like, horrified that, like, I don't have the special pillowcase and I'm not using the special shampoo, and, like, my hair is gonna fall out and I'm gonna be bald.
What does a special
because
pillowcase
I'm not
look like?
Well, you're supposed to use either silk or
why silk?
A really high quality satin, because your hair doesn't catch on it and then it doesn't break off.
Oh.
The same reason that you're supposed to wrap it, or you're supposed to sleep with, like, a little silk or satin, like, cap on your head, which I've tried to do.
Do you have Jerry Curl Jiffy Pop hats? Is that what's happening here?
I kind of do. Mine kind of looks like that when I put my bonnet on it.
Oh my god. Your bonnet. You
have a bonnet? I have one too. It just never stays on, and I'm not old enough apparently to be able to figure out how it can stay on.
I think there's like a universe of things that women are tricked into spending money on that men wouldn't know about anyway.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true.
Yeah.
That explains the radio silence from half of the table.
Thank you, Tracy, for talking with us. I know you have country ass shit you should be doing, like shooting bottle off of fences and stuff.
Right.
Shut up.
I gotta go stop the pigs and shit like that. Absolutely. I hate you, man. I just want you to know.
Don't worry, we all do.
Thank you so much, sis.
That was fun. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Yay.
We'll have to do it again.
Okay.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay, I think we're gonna move on to the shout outs now. Jamel.
I'm gonna shout out the Verizon iPhone. Not because I'm going to get one. I'm poor and I can't afford to cancel a contract and buy a new phone. But because I'm glad Steve Jobs' minimalist warmness can spread to more people. More people should be able to enjoy the iPhone. It's an amazing device.
Jamel is completely a Steve Jobs apologist. Yeah,
yeah. I will not defend everything Apple does, but basic. I mean, like, there's a few things I won't defend.
He hasn't found a thing he won't defend.
Basically. Are you going to go on a rant about codecs and stuff?
No. I hate everyone at this table.
Cool.
I'm not going to shout out heirloom beans, but so I'm going to shout out a couple of different things that I think that you should absolutely read. The New Yorker has been on a tear lately. They had a really great article about sort of the history and the future of bananas. There is a really great, this was maybe a month ago.
I remember this.
Yeah, there's a really, really, really good piece about the history of the conflict in Sri Lanka and Tamil Tigers and sort of the outrageous counterinsurgency that the Sri Lankan army used that word, but, you know, you sort of have to wonder at what cause, but they've had a lot of really, really fantastic pieces. So if you're not a subscriber, I think that it's worth it. I made a New Year's resolution to read a book every week, and I am woefully behind on that, but right. Goddammit, I have managed to read The New Yorker every single week, which is quite the accomplishment for me. The other piece that I'm going to shout out is pretty old. It's from, and I don't want to get this wrong, it's not the Seattle Post Intelligencer, I think it's the Seattle Times, wrote a absolutely amazing piece about, I believe it's 2006 Washington Huskies, called Victory and Ruins, that just, Monica mentioned this in a post that she wrote for Tapped. I go on a rant a lot about how I don't understand why people are still upset at Michael Vick, because there are other human beings in the NFL that treat other people the way that he treated dogs, and it's sort of like that thing that I get up on, one of the many things I get up on my soapbox about. But this piece sort of delves into a lot of current and former players for the NFL, a lot of the problems that they had that were manifesting themselves in college and basically made no difference whatsoever in their college careers or and where they were drafted or how they were paid by the NFL. And it's just a really, it's a really good, really well-written piece. So those are my shout-outs and things that you should be reading.
Okay, Monica?
So yeah, Nicole was the friend that I alluded to in my post about football players just out there having fun a while ago on Tap. So I have two things to shout out. One is my coworker Gabriel Arana is getting married on Saturday.
Yay!
And
we're recording this on Thursday, so by the time you hear this,
he will be a married man.
Yeah.
And he wrote a piece about what it means to get married called "Redefining Marriage" for the American Prospect Online that you guys should all read if you haven't read. And the funny thing about it, so he is marrying his longtime partner in D.C., which is one of the few places that allow gay marriages. And he was writing about how the argument that gay couples are redefining marriage is so silly because every couple redefines marriage every time they do it, and marriage has been a fluid fluidly defined thing for a long time now anyway. And so the funny thing is that the National Organization of Marriage, which is an anti-gay marriage group, posted it on their website to say, see, they are redefining marriage, which I thought was like
very they refer to Gabe's piece.
Yeah. Wow. Which I thought was like
Gabe great. Is the homosexual agenda.
Yeah, I thought it was really funnily, like, hilariously clueless. The other thing I'm going to shout out is Robert Krulrich, who is a science correspondent for NPR, who is one of the co-hosts of Radio Lab, which is a radio show that we'll shout out a lot, I think, had a really great little piece on Morning Edition the other day about interviewing someone who claims that there has never been a tool invented that isn't still in use somewhere, and not just in use, but being made new. So even if you want to try to find a five-hole seed planter, which is like this archaic agricultural tool that you can see in the 1880s Montgomery Ward catalog for American farmers, there's someone making that for either like an Amish population or a developing world population still today that is still in use today. So that technology never really, any kind of new technological advance never really goes extinct, which is a really cool idea. And it's a really funny little piece.
Okay. Well, speaking of, since you said Radiolab, I actually want to shout out something that was on Radiolab on the most recent episode. It was called, there's a segment called Finding Emily, and I don't want to ruin it for anybody. The whole episode is about being lost, and whatever that way that means. And so Emily Gossio, who was the person at the center of the story, there's no way I can really talk about it without giving it away. But she lives in Brooklyn with her boyfriend, and she goes out on a bike ride one day, and she ends up she gets hit by a truck, and then so she's essentially, she's not a vegetable, but she can't communicate with the outside world, and so the story is, this is a true story, the story is kind of about her boyfriend who was like wildly in love with her, and her mother kind of coming to grips with the fact that this person they have in common is kind of gone. And the second shout out is this movie called Bigger, Stronger, Faster from 2008, which is a documentary about steroids. And it's not a perfect documentary by any means, but it's a really thought-provoking one. Basically, it kind of makes the argument that a lot of shit we know about steroids, when we talk about steroids, it's like popularly accepted, is stupid, that like all the stuff they talk about in regards to side effects kind of goes away like after you stop using steroids. So like, yes, your balls shrink and all this crazy stuff happens, and then you stop using steroids and you go back to being a normal person. And so all the stuff they talk about, like word rage and stuff like that, there's no real scientific evidence for that. And like, so Lyle Alzado, who was an NFL player who died of like brain cancer or something, who had publicly like had been well known to use steroids, there's never been a link between cancer and steroids, but everyone linked his brain cancer to steroids. And it's like part of this very interesting conversation about the way we talk about performance enhancing drugs and sports. It's like, you know what I mean? So like, what is imbalance and what isn't? It's a really fascinating documentary, and it's kind of centered on the director's brother, who has dreams of being a professional wrestler and like dreams of being really big. And kind of a postscript to the movie is that his brother dies a few years after the documentary, or actually the year the documentary came out. So anyway, it should be on Netflix. I think you should holler at it when you get a chance.
In the absence of Joel, can I add extras to my shout out? Absolutely. You, like the Radiolab thing just reminded me of that. So the last two new episodes of This American Life, Kid Politics, and Slow to React.
Good as hell.
Slow to React was really good.
They've both been fantastic, but I highly recommend that you listen to just the first act if you're not going to listen to anything else of both of those. The first act of Kid Politics is about these kids impersonating Robert Reagan and Ronald Reagan.
That's
like,
his cousin.
Right. Like, if you listen to this act and you don't find something, like, kind of really terribly wrong about how these kids are being prompted to answer these questions and this experience that they go through, like, I don't even know if I can talk to you anymore. Yes. And then the second one, called Slow to React. The first act is like in no way suitable for work. It is not suitable for anyone like under the age of 25. Like, it's, the first act is,
we'll say 18.
All right, 18.
So Jamel can listen to it.
I'm barely over 25.
Jamel can listen to it with adults.
Right. But like, this first act is hands down one of the most mind-boggling pieces I have ever heard on public radio on This American Life. Like,
yeah, absolutely.
It's unbelievable.
Okay. So we've been here for a long ass time. So on behalf of Jamel and Nicole and Monica and Channing Kennedy and Tracy / Broken Poverty, this is DD, and we will have you soon. Be easy.